You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
Most of the time, there's not an effort to engage in your argument in any good faith. People will just paint you as a homophobe. So it really has just kind of narrowed and shriveled the bounds of discourse.
My grandmother used to say, don't be so open-minded that your brains fall out. There are some scholars who would really like something to be true who unfortunately become too open-minded, too uncritical.
If I'm looking inside myself for strength, it will fail, but that's not actually where my strength comes from, that Christ is greater than my heart.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love Issues, etc.
The word secularist or secularism, it's taken on a meaning far beyond what it had in its origins. It used to just mean of the world in a kind of neutral sense or something to do with the world. Now, it not only means worldly in a theological sense, it's in most people's minds, it means the opposite of religion, even opposition to religion. We were warned for a long time by religious voices in the United States about the secularists. But is it the opposite of religion? Is it more like religion than even the secularist would admit, or even the Christian would admit? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Thursday afternoon, July the 7th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Mary Eberstadt joins us to talk about religious freedom and secular orthodoxy. She's written the book called It's Dangerous to Believe. I'm sure you've heard about it. We'll be talking with her for the first hour of Issues, Etc. In the second hour, Terry Mattingly joins us for a brief conversation on media coverage of the life and the faith of the late Pat Summitt, the winningest coach in the history of Division I college basketball. Only one place did he find an important fact of her life that was left out every place else in the voluminous coverage of her life and her accomplishments. Then it's time for Christ in the Old Testament. We'll be in Psalm 41, O Lord, be gracious to me. Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. You can join us with questions or comments or call in number 1-877-623-MY-IE. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. Our beloved on-demand listeners, whenever, wherever you listen, feel free to use the Issues, Etc. comment line 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about religious freedom and secular orthodoxy, Mary Eberstadt. She's a regular guest, a cultural analyst, an essayist, and author of numerous books, including her latest, It's Dangerous to Believe. Mary, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Usually when we hear the term secularism or secularist, we think of it in terms of kind of the opposite of religion. Is that true?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because for a long time, I think this idea has been out there that the new atheists also talked about, that the metaphysical struggle is between religion and unreligion, belief and disbelief. But I make the case that actually what's going on is that we now have a rival faith in Western civilization. It is a historical first. It's a secularist faith that is based on the sexual revolution. And the contest out there is not between people who believe nothing and people who believe in Christianity. It's instead between people who believe in this new secularist faith, whether they recognize it or not, and people of more traditional belief.
You say that the fundamental principle of this secularist orthodoxy, as you call it, its new master ethic, is doing what you want. Expand on that, if you would.
Yes, I think the technological shock of the birth control pill half a century ago has changed the way many people live and the way many people think. And this idea has come up among people opposed to traditional Christianity that instead the imperative should be pleasure, and it follows from that that anything that gets in the way of pleasure is wrong. And that, I think, is why we see this fierce attack on Christianity in the public square these days, Todd, because people resent traditional Christian teachings about putting any restraints whatsoever on sexual expression. And we're seeing this manifest in all kinds of ways. Of course, there was the controversy over same-sex marriage. Now it's transgender bathrooms. But all of these things are joined by a common denominator, which is that they are all initiatives put forward by people who put the sexual revolution ahead of traditional Christian and other moral teaching.
So it's not a conflict between morality and amorality or immorality per se. It's a conflict between two very different moralities.
It's a conflict between two different conceptions of morality. And one, the traditional Judeo-Christian conception, puts limits on sexual expression for various deep reasons. The other faith, this new secularist faith, holds that sexual expression is the highest good. And so, of course, there are bound to be clashes between these two very different worldviews, and we are seeing this play out in our politics, in our schools, pretty much everywhere in Western civilization these days.
You also say that it mimics Christianity in many ways. What do you mean?
The interesting thing is that it shares certain recognizable features with Christianity. So, for example, there are certain figures in this new secularist faith who are revered, like Alfred Kinsey, like Margaret Mead, Margaret Sanger. There are a number of thinkers who are off limits for revisionism because they are foundational to this new faith. So, as Christianity has its tradition of scholasticism, the new secularist religion has its tradition. It also has what I call a demonology, that is, it does believe that there are evil forces in the form of Christian activists and Christian thought and Christian moral teaching. So in various ways, I think you see this overlap. This is clearly some offshoot of Christianity, although it's unrecognizable as a Christian faith.
Why does it single out, it sounds like you're almost talking about a Christian heresy. Why does it single out Christianity more often than not and not take aim as often at other religions that also put, for different reasons, put limits on self-gratification and in particular, sexual ethics?
Well, there are a couple of reasons for that, I think, Todd. One is that Christianity is the majority faith in the United States and in the Western, most of the Western world. Even people who have fallen away from it still identify themselves as Christians. So in terms of sheer numbers, it's the biggest target out there. But it's also the case that for a long time now, there has been a double standard according to which Christians, and especially Protestant evangelical Christians, could be mocked in ways that really would be deplored if they were directed at people of other faiths. And I think Christians have gotten into a sort of defensive crouch on their own, where they're sort of used to being publicly vilified in this way and tend not to push back against it the way I think a lot of other people would. So for different reasons, there is this double standard that has developed about being able to say things about Christians that are not said of other faiths, even other faiths that share this traditional moral teaching.
The other key thing that you point out in your book is that all of this comes in an atmosphere or within the framework of what you call some kind of panic. What do you mean by that?
There is something deeply irrational about today's secularist attacks on Christianity. And I am not saying everyone who is not a Christian is part of this, but there is something out of touch with reality about going after Christians in the public square, in school rooms, pretty much everywhere. And what I mean by that is that if you take a step back and you look at the big picture, of course what we see is that tradition-minded Christians have been losing on the culture war front over and over for decades now. They lost on school prayer, they lost on abortion, same-sex marriage, all kinds of related issues. So when secularists go around acting as if Christians are controlling the levers of power, there's something really unhinged about that. And I think it's fair to point that out. We have had two terms of a very progressive administration in Washington, and the initiatives coming from that administration are anything but aligned with traditional Christianity. So, again, there is something out of bounds about suggesting that Christians are a majority, or at least the tradition-minded Christians are a majority in this country and controlling the levers of power. Plainly, they're not.
You even use the word witch hunt. Why is that inappropriate in this case?
Because the people who want to diminish Christianity's influence in our country are acting like inquisitors. They're not acting like people who want to live and let live. They're not acting like people who are seeing their friends and neighbors and sons and daughters who are Christian as equal members of society. No, they are carrying on as if they're not going to stop until there's no expression of Christian moral teaching anywhere in public. So you see, for example, attacks on homeschooling, which is something I talk about in the book. There are activists out there who want to shut down homeschooling because they are afraid that's how religion is being transmitted. There are attacks on Christian higher education. We've seen two accreditation battles against flagship Protestant schools in the last 10 years. So on all of these fronts, there is just something deeply antagonistic and irrational animus, if you will, against Christianity.
Mary Eberstadt is our guest, author of the book It's Dangerous to Believe. When we come back, we're going to talk about the paring down of the term religious liberty or religious freedom to mere freedom to worship. Stay tuned.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Children are a heritage from the Lord, but what of those who've not been given the gift of a child? The cross of barrenness affects not only childless couples, it affects the family, friends, and pastors who love and care for them. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm partnering with Emmanuel Press to publish the second edition of my book, He Remembers the Barren, a story about the hope and contentment found only in Christ, no matter the cross we bear. Visit emmanuelpress.us to learn more. emmanuelpress.us.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilken. Mary Eberstadt is our guest. We're talking about religious freedom and secular orthodoxy. She's authored the book, It's Dangerous to Believe. Mary, talk a bit about, if you would, the paring down of the term religious liberty to mere freedom to worship as one pleases.
Well, this is something that probably a lot of listeners are not aware of. I wasn't aware of it, Todd, until I was doing research for the book. But over the past two terms of the Obama administration, in various key documents and other public statements, freedom of religion, which is what has traditionally been talked about, what's in the First Amendment, has been steadily redefined as freedom of worship. That is a crucial distinction because freedom of religion means that you're free to express your religion in whatever way you think is appropriate that doesn't hurt other people. Freedom of worship sounds like something that is only done in private. It sounds like something you could do in your closet all by yourself. So the redefinition of religious freedom as freedom of worship is one more sign that we are looking at an attempt to constrict religious liberty.
What then becomes of the fuller language that actually I think we ought to be using more consistently from the U.S. Constitution, and that is the free exercise of religion?
Well, we should be emphasizing that, too. And here, too, Todd, I think there's an unfortunate double standard, which is when people exercise their religion by writing out a check to a charity, for example, or dropping off food at a soup kitchen, no one seems to object to that. It's only when people exercise their religion by expressing what they think about a certain kind of morality that they come into the inquisitor's sights and get hounded out of the public square. So it's worth pointing out that not all exercises of religion are judged to be out of bounds. People don't have a consistent standard about that.
When they make their attacks, they often do it in the name of diversity. What does that mean in secularist orthodoxy, diversity?
Well, diversity, unfortunately, has come to have a kind of cynical meaning where it's taken to apply only to people outside religious circles, anti-religious people often. But true diversity, of course, would value all of us, whether we're Protestant fundamentalists or Hindus or what have you. So part of what I'm trying to do with this argument is to hold people outside of religious circles to their own stated standards. And this was inspired by watching and reading about Martin Luther King. This was his entire strategy, was to hold people to their stated principles and to point out when they were falling short of those principles. And that's what I'm trying to do here, Todd. I'm saying if people really mean what they say about the importance of tolerance and inclusivity and diversity, then they have to apply those same standards to the Christians with whom they disagree.
Now, if they're just kind of a thought experiment, if this secularist orthodoxy, if it actually did embrace diversity, genuine diversity that you're talking about, there could be peaceful coexistence, couldn't there?
Well, we're going to have to get there somehow, but we aren't there yet, that's for sure. And the reason we're not there is not that the Christians are going after the secularists and trying to shut down their schools and interfere with their charities and other examples that I give in the book. The animus is not coming from the Christian side. It's coming from the side of people who feel irrationally threatened by the existence of people who think differently. That is the secularist side.
One example that you cite, of course, and you mentioned before is homeschooling. Talk about their particular animus and combativeness toward this.
Well, the National Education Association has actually said that homeschooling cannot deliver a full education. I think millions of homeschooling families across the country would think otherwise. There have also been attacks on homeschooling across the new atheism. Richard Dawkins has said that homeschooling is a form of child abuse. Now, again, the double standard applies. If you were a secularist and you were homeschooling with books by Philip Pullman and Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, etc., it seems unlikely that anybody would go after you for that. So when people object to homeschooling, they are objecting to Christian homeschooling, and some of them are explicit about that, as I note in the book.
What in particular do they find objectionable about it? Is it because it's outside a government control, or is it because, I'm at a loss here to figure out what they find so objectionable about it.
It is puzzling to think that some people make it their business to try and interfere with the way other people raise their kids, right? I agree with you, Todd. What they find objectionable is the idea that if the Christian moral code, the traditional code, is transmitted to children, then those children are going to be intolerant of certain other people who don't share that moral code. I'm putting the best possible construal on the argument. The people who go after homeschooling are not people who put liberty first, obviously. And in the book, I cite the example of John Stuart Mill, who was, of course, a great liberal thinker who was himself schooled at home by his father and who noted that government schools tend to turn out people who think the same way. So there's an example of when secularism and progressivism goes after homeschooling, secularism and progressivism are forgetting their own roots in John Stuart Mill.
What do we need to know about the kind of the broader term culture war in order to rightly understand your argument?
Well, I think culture war is an unfortunate term, and it always has been. I mean, we should try to reserve war for a real war. But, of course, it's shorthand for the contest between tradition-minded faiths and other things. And I think what we've seen is an ascendant secularism, a rival faith. We have entered a new chapter in the culture wars for this reason. It is now, I think, clear that on many issues dear to the hearts of traditionalists, they have lost and matters are settled in a way that pleases the other side. It's precisely for this reason, Todd, that I think it's fair to ask, if that's where we are in the culture war, then why not back off from the incessant attacks on Christianity out there?
And yet what we see here, and again, I'm kind of just speaking from my own observation, is that when things are termed, I'm thinking about the term war on women, the steps that are taken legally, socially, at every front of our society to squelch the free exercise of religion are framed as, well, we got to do this. We're defending women. A defensive stance is what is claimed. Sounds like you're saying that's specious.
Well, it is specious. And what proves it are the attacks on crisis pregnancy centers. Now, this, too, is something that a lot of us would not have thought about unless we had had occasion to do this research. There are crisis pregnancy centers across the country, many run by religious people, some not. And they are the object of litigation by secularists who want to shut them down, by pro-abortion people who don't think these centers should exist. Well, what do the centers do? They provide counseling and free sonograms and diapers and other material help to women who want to have a baby, women who don't want to choose abortion. So in what possible world could that be a good thing to do? In what possible world is that a pro-woman thing to do, to try and shut down these places that are helping often desperate women? So the fact that attacks on that kind of charity even exist go to show that there's a lot more going on in this war on women rhetoric than is immediately obvious.
What role then, since we're on the subject of abortion, what role does abortion play in secular orthodoxy?
Well, I think it's the equivalent of a central sacrament. It is ferociously protected. We saw this in the example of what happened at the Supreme Court last week over the state of Texas's attempts to hold abortion clinics to a higher medical standard. That decision, of course, went the other way, and there was jubilation on the steps of the Supreme Court among pro-abortion people. They were not acting like regular demonstrators in a political environment. They were celebrating, Todd. They were blaring music. They were crying. They were hugging each other. They were dancing, all because their central sacrament, as it were, had been once again protected from infringement. Now, there is something, I submit, weird going on in the country, to put it mildly, when people are so zealous in celebrating the fact of abortion. You know, yesterday's liberals used to say it should be safe, legal, and rare. It shouldn't be something to be celebrated. But that's what we see now, and I think we're seeing that because it has come to be the centerpiece of this new secularist religion.
We're talking about religious freedom and secular orthodoxy. Mary Eberstadt, author of the book It's Dangerous to Believe, is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
If you've ever wondered why Amazing Grace is the national anthem of funerals, or pondered the state of your eternal soul after you die, the Lutheran Witness has got you covered. Check out the June-July issue of The Lutheran Witness to learn more about death, dying, heaven, and hell. Not a subscriber? Visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness for a special offer, $6.99 for 6 digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
I'm Pastor Watson. Are you tired of entertainment and in need of the peace that passes human understanding? I invite you to Augsburg Lutheran Church in Shawnee, Kansas, to receive the gifts of Jesus. Augsburg is scriptural, traditional, historical, sacramental, and reverent. The Church of the Apostles, the Councils, and the Reformers wants to be your church family also. For more information, visit us at augsburglutheranchurch.org.
If you've ever attended an Issues Etc. conference or any number of events that take place across the Synod and have wondered why more people from my congregation aren't here, check out the special seminar package the CLCC is offering for the 500th anniversary. All you need so the pastors of your circuit can organize, promote, and present a seminar that appeals to the members of your congregation, even the youth, is provided free by the CLCC. Just go to theclcc.org and click on the blue box, or check us out on Facebook.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Religious liberty, Christians engaging the media, the for you of Christianity, Christian marriage, the sexual revolution, the Benedict option. These are some of the topics for the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Registration is $120. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston.
Celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation with the new Martin Luther plush figure. It features the 16th century reformer holding the Bible and Luther's morning and evening prayers. Go to reformationgear.com, use the coupon code ISSUESETC, and 20% of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. ReformationGear.com, the new Martin Luther plush figure, ReformationGear.com, and enter the coupon code ISSUESETC. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about religious freedom and secular orthodoxy with Mary Eberstadt, a cultural analyst, essayist, and author of numerous books, including her latest, It's Dangerous to believe. Issues Etc. is proud to welcome a new advertiser, Lutheran Federal Credit Union. It's here to serve Lutheran Church Missouri Synod members nationwide. Lutheran Federal Credit Union provides checking and savings accounts, home, car, and personal loans, on-demand mobile banking, and 30,000 ATMs. Lutheran Federal Credit Union is exclusively for members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Visit LutheranFCU.org to get to know your new neighbor, LutheranFCU.org, Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Mary, let's talk about marriage, that in natural marriage, I should say, or traditional marriage by another name. What is the source of the animus against natural marriage among the adherents to secular orthodoxy?
It's of a piece with the same fervor that defends abortion. Essentially, anything in the Christian moral code that runs afoul of what any consenting adult might want to do with his or her body is objected to ferociously. And what's interesting, Todd, is there's such a felt need among secularists and progressives to disallow people even from thinking differently. There's something really new and un-American about that, about wanting to penalize people just for what they think, just because some people might think someone else's action is wrong. And again, there's a certain measure of irrationalism about this. If you don't believe in hell in the first place, if you're, you know, a good card-carrying secular person, and you don't believe that there's such a thing as eternal reward or eternal punishment, then why should it matter to you that other people believe in those things? You see, there's an illogic about it that I think needs to be teased out.
What has the secular orthodoxy done to language? I'm thinking in particular about its use of both euphemisms and epithets, the euphemisms like reproductive health or choice, things like that, and then its epithets of homophobe or bigot?
Well, great question. So about the latter, these terrible slurs are hurled at people these days. They're called phobes and haters and bigots. This, again, is why I use the metaphor of the witch hunt in the book, because there's no evidence in almost all these cases that the people who are being accused of hating actually hate anyone at all. People are accused of being haters and bigots just because they're Christians. In no other form of public life, I think, would people get away with that kind of name-calling. And it really ought to stop because it's destructive of civil society itself. Now, as to the question of what about maligning language in other ways, choice is a very good example of that. I mean, once again, secularists and progressives say that they're pro-choice, but if you choose to have a baby, they're going to make your life more difficult by going after the people who want to help you do that. So it's not really about choice.
I'm intrigued by the point that you've made here several times, that this is fundamentally irrational, that it doesn't even kind of cohere together in an internal consistency. What kind of endpoint, then, Mary, is there to a secular orthodoxy that isn't driven by any kind of rationality?
Well, my hope is to appeal over the heads of the activists out there who are the carriers of that orthodoxy to other people on their side who are not religious zealots, as it were. That is to say, the left is not a monolith. Progressivism is not a monolith. Secularism is not a monolith. What's needed is for people of reasonable mind who are genuinely believers in tolerance to come forward and dissociate themselves from the sorts of punitive measures that are being taken against Christians. In the book, I give examples of other times in history when this kind of effort has been needed. So, for example, after the Salem witch trials, there was a massive realignment of opinion in Salem, Massachusetts, and elsewhere. People thought, what have we done? We made a terrible mistake. And the effort toward a more civil society was led by Puritans themselves. by ministers in particular. So it takes people on the side of where the errors are being committed to grasp the initiative and make things right. And that's what I'm hoping this book accomplishes in some modest way. I hope it holds up the record of what is happening to traditional religious believers in this country in a way that makes people on the other side say, you know what, that's not what I want for America. I don't want to be part of that.
In that vein, do you see any evidence in your research that, for lack of a better word, old-fashioned liberals are seeing this for what it is?
Yes, I do, Todd. In fact, one particularly compelling example, I think, is that when the former CEO of Mozilla, Brendan Eich, lost his position a few years back, he lost it because a social media campaign revealed that he had donated $1,000 on behalf of traditional marriage, and he was essentially hounded from his position and called a bigot and a hater, etc., because of that. And when that happened, scores of people signed a document called Freedom to Marry, Freedom to Dissent, Why We Must Have Both. Now, these were people, most of them people of the left, including some prominent leaders of the same-sex marriage initiative, who were appalled by what had happened to the CEO of a major company, how he had lost his job because of what he believed. And so they signed this document saying, we have to get along with each other. We have to make room for differences in belief. I think there could be a lot more of that kind of thing down the road, because the ferocity of the secularist faith has become so pronounced that there are people being exiled as heretics who, you know, were themselves progressives and secularists in good standing until very recently. The doctrine that secularism holds to now is evolving so quickly that people actually can't keep up. And so there are whole new categories of transgressors out there, that is, people who run afoul of whatever we're now supposed to think about transgender stuff and other stuff. So I do think there's room for a new conversation about getting along that's in the vein of that document I mentioned. We could see a lot more of that, and it would be a good thing for the country if we did.
This tendency for it to evolve quickly, as you said, coupled with its irrational impulse, does that signal a point at which it eventually burns out or runs out of issues?
Well, we've seen from examples in history that there are times when society is consumed by some kind of irrationalist panic. You don't have to go all the way back to the witch trials. There was the Red Scare of the 1950s, when some people were justly accused of being communists, but some people who were not communists were accused of being communists. And there again, it took people on that side of the aisle to make things right. That is, it took 7 Republican senators leading the charge against Joseph McCarthy and saying things have gone too far. So we do see that society does this. We saw this in the 1980s as well. There was a collective hysteria about sexual abuse in daycare centers. And it turned out, as painstaking research revealed, that these accusations were without merit. There were people who lost their jobs. There were people who went to prison who shouldn't have. So we do see these things happen, and then we see them made right. And the point is, who has the power to make them right? In the case of belligerent secularism versus traditional Christians, it's not the Christians who have the power to call off the inquisitors and to say, we need to take a step toward a more civil place. It's the other side that needs to do it.
Talk a bit about what happens when the secularist orthodoxy gains access to, as you said, the levers of power. In particular, I'm thinking here of the courts.
Well, what happens is playing out around the country now. What happens is you've got people who think that Christians, just in virtue of what they believe, are somehow second-class moral citizens. And that shouldn't be the case. the name-calling should go away. The intolerance toward people who think differently should be denounced for the un-American thing that it is.
Mary Eberstadt is our guest. We're talking about religious freedom and secular orthodoxy. When we come back, how would you respond to someone who says, look, Christians have held the levers of power in America for a long time. It's time for a little payback. We'll be right back.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper every service every Sunday, preaching Christ crucified and risen, our hope for years to come, there is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is, 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri. Find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We've got 10 more minutes in our conversation on this Thursday afternoon with Mary Eberstadt, a cultural analyst, essayist, and author of numerous books, including her latest, It's Dangerous to Believe, talking about religious freedom and secular orthodoxy. Then Terry Mattingly will join us in Hour 2 of Issues Etc. We'll talk about media coverage of the life and the passing of Pat Summitt, the winningest coach in the history of Division I college basketball. He found some people willing to mention her faith in the obituaries and in the treatments of her life and faith, and many others simply leaving that part out. Then Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will join us. We'll do Christ in the Old Testament, Psalm 41. Mary, how would you respond to someone who says, look, people with a Christian or Christian-ish worldview have held the levers of power in the United States for a long, long time and not always done well with it, and what we're seeing here is just a little bit of a payback?
Well, I'm sure that that is a powerful feeling, and since Christianity teaches that we're all sinners to begin with, there is no doubt that a lot of people who are Christian have done bad things in history, have treated other people unfairly, and in a way not justified by Christianity's own principles. So I think there's a lot of desire to see payback, Todd. But is that really what we want to base a country on? Again, getting back to the example of Martin Luther King, that wasn't King's strategy. His whole strategy was to start by forgiving the people who had done wrong and to move on from there. We see none of that magnanimity in the kind of aggressive secularism that goes after Christianity these days. Martin Luther King, a religious man, would disown this kind of aggressive secularism.
So where does this begin? I mean, that is the focus of your book, and that is to try and recapture the genuine values of tolerance, the genuine virtue of diversity, especially of thought and action. What's the path forward for that?
Well, in a way, I think we may have been handed something of a good break, because for better or worse, what's going on in national politics right now has made a lot of people think of the word civility, right? We've seen a very uncivil campaign season, and a lot of people who don't agree about politics still have the same sense of wondering, how did we get here, and how can we get out of here and back to a more civil place? Well, I think one way of doing that is to recognize that before there was the kind of incivility we see on the national stage today, there was a groundswell of incivility against Christians, starting earlier than the new atheism, but really picking up steam about 10 years ago when all those atheist tracts appeared. And that kind of incivility is very much of a piece with the kind of incivility that we see in national politics now. So, in a way, the fact that things have gotten as bad as they have, Todd, makes me think that there's a lot of people out there who want to see them get better, and that's a hopeful thing.
People think of it in sometimes just purely pragmatic or political terms, and they say, well, look, we had for the last 8 years a president who came in promising all of these things, and yet, sadly, has either been unable or unwilling to deliver on them. What are your thoughts there?
Well, it's hard to think of how this president could be a unifier when he has gone out of his way to be disrespectful to American Christians. Do you remember, Todd, a few years back, President Obama said at a prayer breakfast of all places that there were less than loving Christians in this country. That's a direct quote, less than loving. Can you imagine an American president saying that of any other religious group? It's unthinkable. But that's not the only time that he has chosen to go after non-progressive American Christians. There was that infamous quote from several years back about people clinging to their guns and their religion and being bitter. So it's hard to see how his administration could have been more magnanimous when obviously he is on the side of people who carry this animosity toward traditional Christians. And I'm not saying he's not a Christian. I am saying that he has a clear animus against people who are not the kind of progressive Christian he is.
Some people are going to say, well, is it a grassroots conversation or is it a national conversation? How would you respond to that question?
It has to be both. It has to be both. It's to be hoped that whoever is the next president is inclusive of all people in this country and not just the ones he or she happens to agree with most. So the tone has to be set at the national level for sure, but also in local communities. Just understanding that your Christian neighbor is not wearing figurative horns and a tail and doesn't deserve to be called a hater and a bigot is a step forward. And I think we can get there.
You write this near the end of your book. There is no way around it. Secularist progressivism must find what it has so far resisted, which is a way of living with the believers without exiling them as heretics or ignoring what they have to say, in hope that they will someday, somehow, become mere petrified artifacts of capital H history. What are you saying there?
I'm saying that it is impossible to stamp out religion, period. The apparent secularist desire to drive Christians into their homes, to worship all by themselves and out of sight, will never work. It won't work because most of humanity leans in toward religion. The history of human beings is a history of religion after religion. There have been movements that have tried to make that all go away. The great totalitarian movements of the 20th century were anti-established and organized religion. If they couldn't make it work, then secularists in relatively free societies aren't going to be able to make it work either. So that's point one. And point two is that history also shows that religious revival is always around the corner. No one ever sees it coming. So for various reasons, this apparent secularist project to diminish Christianity to such a point that Christians are not allowed to express themselves without social opprobrium or other kinds of punishment is bound to fail. And that is something that secularist progressivism needs to realize.
On that term, progressivism, since there's really nothing new under the sun, and you pointed this out in your book, you have example after example of these moral panics that have come and gone. Is secular progressivism really progressive?
Well, that's a great question, Todd. It certainly doesn't seem to be bending toward justice at the moment. It is bending toward injustice for people who think differently. So in that sense, no, it is not generating moral progress. It's generating the opposite.
Do you think, and let's speak here just about the activist, not the old-fashioned liberal who may be starting to feel uneasy with all of this, but doesn't want to say anything because part of, you know, he's being able to tick off some of his agenda items with this. But do you think that the activist has thought through to the end point what kind of society, in detail, they really want to see America become?
No, I don't think there's a lot of reflection on that end. And that's another reason why I explicitly address people like that in the book. That is, people who think differently, who think like secularists and progressives. Because I don't think, first of all, that they are self-consciously aware of having evolved a new quasi-religion. And if they're not aware of that, then they're also likely not aware of other fallout from the position they take. They may not even know, some of them, the injustices that are being committed in their movement's name. So I think there's room for a lot of consciousness raising on the secularist side, to use an old-fashioned phrase from the 60s.
Finally, if not the way forward that you suggest and urge in your book, which is to live at peace with one another in genuine tolerance and diversity, what's the alternative to that, Mary?
More of what we see today, which is increasingly fractured societies where people stay in their electronic silos and get their news from sources they trust and don't go out and interact with other people. And the problem with all of that is that it's terrible for democracy because the exchange of ideas is critical. The idea of the marketplace of ideas is a liberal idea, and it's critical to building up society. So we can't stay at each other's throats in the way that we seem to have become accustomed to, especially during the past 10 years of attacks on Christianity. I think everybody has the feeling, or many people have the feeling, that we could get to some better place. And the way to do it is by calling off the witch hunt against Christians and having an honest conversation out there about why things have gone as far as they have. And I think I'm optimistic that we can have that conversation.
Mary Eberstadt is a cultural analyst, essayist, and author of numerous books, including her latest, Dangerous to Believe. You'll find a link to it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Mary, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Todd. It's always a pleasure.
Have you taken advantage of the special opportunity Concordia University, Wisconsin has offered Issues Etc. listeners? They'll waive your application fee when you enter the promo code ISSUES. Concordia University, Wisconsin online offers 50 online educational options for associate's, bachelor's, or master's degrees. You can find out more by clicking the Concordia University, Wisconsin logo at issuesetc.org. Lifelong Lutheran learning. Concordia University, Wisconsin online. When we come back, Terry Mattingly will join us. We're going to talk about media coverage of the life of the late Pat Summitt and her faith. Not much coverage of her faith. A lot of her life. She's the winningest coach in the history of Division I college basketball. Terry Mattingly will be our guest. Then we'll turn this to the subject of Christ in the Old Testament. We'll talk about Psalm 41. O Lord, be gracious to me, with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer, host of the weekly radio talk show called Redeemer Theological Academy. When we come back, Terry Mattingly of GetReligion.org will talk about how the media covered the life and the faith of Pat Summitt. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Our Savior Lutheran, Westminster, Massachusetts. Redeemer Lutheran, Fairhope, Alabama. St. Matthew Lutheran, Stony Plain, Alberta, Canada. Holy Cross Lutheran, Moline, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Munster, Indiana. St. John Lutheran, Racine, Wisconsin. Calvary Lutheran, Baltimore, Maryland. Reformation Lutheran, Afton, Missouri. Emmanuel Lutheran, Lima, Ohio. Risen Lord Lutheran, Taylorsville, Kentucky, Prince of Peace Lutheran, Crystal Lake, Illinois, and Trinity Lutheran, Elmore, Ohio. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes a congregational sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal, the Issues Etc. 300.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office. 314-416-8117.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.